told me that all I will accomplish is to get chalk on the tie, believe it or not. So one of the differences between being a first-year faculty member and a seventh-year faculty member is you learn to take your jacket off. Okay. Good news and bad news recordings for last week, and I apologize for not putting them up yet. Part of why will become evident in a minute. I had a proposal deadline yesterday at 4:30 that went down to 4:22. So things have been a little crazy for about the last 5 days. For last week, we have good news and bad news. The good news is that Scott Dory was around and was able to record the second half of the class with his recorder. You'll notice that I now have a new one. And the reason is the old one died. So unfortunately, the recording of the first half of last time is gone. Most of that chunk was, you know, review of basic OS material, and I apologize. There's nothing really I can do. We will get the recordings that exist online today and tomorrow. In fact, last night I even reformatted this thing to make sure I could get the MP3 file off of it onto the Linux machine. So, I'm confident that I can do that, assuming I get data. The second part, I only know how to find out the hard way. Okay. So last time... I talked about system structure, and I talked about hardware structures. And what I want to do today, in the beginning half, is I want to talk a little bit about what do the Kyoto structures look like that correspond to those hardware structures. And then we can actually start looking at basically how they're implemented and what are the issues you run into in implementing. So, talked about a hardware page table scheme where you have a page directory in Intel speak and a page table, and under it you have a page of data, right? So the data is not part of the mapping structure, it's the thing being mapped to. Before I proceed into Kyoto stuff, let me pause and ask, are there questions about this stuff? We're going to sort of walk through this in some detail in the next couple of weeks, but to some of you, I think mapping structures are a new idea, so I should stop and ask. Okay. Either nobody's awake, or nobody has any questions, or everybody is terrified. You want to take a vote? Okay. I did not talk about the hardware view of what is a process. So actually, before I go into Kyotos, let me do that. So every hardware processor that I know about, you know, there's a problem with opening a sentence like that because there's always then the exception that pops to your mind. With the exception of what? Every hardware processor that I know about has essentially a register set, and at least if it's a processor designed for multiprocessing, it has at least one register off on the side where it puts the address space pointer. And depending on which hardware you're looking at, this will be called the address space register, the address space ID, the master page table pointer. Nobody agrees on terminology, okay? But they're all the pointer to the root of the data structure. And the register set effectively is the high performance memory your process gets to use. So from one point of view, the memory structure of a program, of a process, they're really two separate memories, right? One is the so-called main memory, which is the one you address through load and store instructions, and the other is the register set, which is the one whose entries you can encode directly in instructions. If you get down to the assembly level, you'll discover that there are instructions that say things like add into R2, R1, and 5. And if you look down at the binary level, you'll discover that R1 and R2 have binary level encodings that are directly interpreted by the hardware. But the exceptional machine is a very strange machine in which the register is sat at the end of the stack, and so everything kind of went to memory, sort of. The folks who built the compiler for that machine took almost 4 years figuring out how to even think about a compiler for that machine, which is why people did not continue that experiment. It was a processor called the CRISP that was designed by Dave Ditzel before he went off and ruined the Spark. Excuse me. Before he took over the 64-bit Spark effort. Dave founded a company called Transmeta. Right? Transmeta is a processor that implements a Pentium by doing firmware-assisted dynamic translation. Right? So the actual hardware engine is not designed to run Pentium instructions. It's designed to run the output of their dynamic compiler, which was co-designed with the hardware. Okay. When an operating system switches from one process to another, right, the hardware layer doesn't know from a thread model. It doesn't know about processes versus threads. It doesn't know about files. It also doesn't know about peanut butter sandwiches. There's a long list of things hardware knows nothing about. Very much like you and me. From the hardware perspective, what that switch actually amounts to is unloading one set of values from the registers, unloading the address space register, and then loading a new set of values. So in the language of programming languages people, you can think of this thing collectively as a kind of a continuation. Right. It's a funny kind of a continuation because it includes this root of the mapping structure, which in a programming language you wouldn't talk about. And strictly speaking, if you dig into languages that do continuations, you'll discover they have one pointer rather than umpteen registers. Right? But, you know, okay, fine. Save the registers to a data structure and then just keep a pointer to that and call that the continuation. That's kind of just a displacement. It's the state that we care about. So at this layer of abstraction, there's no such thing as a process from the hardware perspective, right? They're just instructions that are executing, updating the register state, and maybe moving things into and out of memory. And the operating system builds a process abstraction out of that, essentially using this as sort of the atomic layer of abstraction. Atomic isn't quite the right word, the bottommost layer of abstraction. It's the pointer to the page directory. That's all. And on most processors, that's a physical address. Anybody want to speculate on why we would not want to use a virtual address for that? Can you imagine a way in which we might? Can you imagine a hardware design that might use a virtual address for the master page table pointer? There is an example of such an architecture. It's called the RS-6000. And the reason they did it is it's much easier to build a processor that doesn't have two modes, virtual and physical. So what they did was they said, well, rather than try to sort out how to build a processor that has these two different modes, we will always run the processor in virtually translated fashion. And the way we will sort of bootstrap this thing out of the dark is we will simply arrange to preload entries into the TLB so that when it goes to do its first access, it already has a well-defined state from which to obtain the answer. And subsequent to that, the operating system will guarantee that there's always a few entries that are locked down, called pinned, in the TLB that will let us resolve the reductio. Or rather, will let us not get caught failing to solve the reductio. So That's actually the heart of what a process is. When you talk about a process in the OS sense or a thread, you're talking about an abstraction that's being built on top of this hardware layer. And that abstraction may work for you, it may work against you, you may not care. The point is, that abstraction is not the core of what's really going on. What's really going on is what's happening on the hardware. Well, so one of the design philosophies that the Kyoto system inherits from three generations of predecessors is the idea that it's not the operating system's job to do abstraction. This idea is heretical. If you open up an OS textbook, right, it'll tell you that the operating system's job is to provide a naturalized interface to the resources of the system. To which my response is, bullshit. The operating system's job is to get out of my way. I did not power up the machine to run the kernel. I powered up the machine to get a problem solved. If abstraction helps me do that, great. But if abstraction imposes overhead, and it always does, not so great. So the idea I want to plant here is that there is a difference between abstraction and canonicalization. Abstraction says, I'm going to take whatever the underlying thing was, and I'm going to build some body of intervening code that's going to make it look like something else. Right. That's how you start at hardware memory mapping and you get to MMAP. And MMAP becomes the common interface. And then, you know, there's nothing between MMAP and the hardware layer that 50,000 lines of code can't fix. Okay. MMAP not only is not a good match for the Pentium hardware, it's not a good match for any real translation architecture, right? It's an interface that's designed to serve the simplification of the job of the program author. There's nothing wrong with that. It just doesn't belong in the kernel. It's good to have standard interfaces. Why do those 50,000 lines need to be inside the portion of the kernel that's capable of taking out everything? So a different approach is to say, look, when you look at the hardware mechanisms, you discover that there are a lot of things these hardware mechanisms all have in common. They may call them by different names. One of them may use a 1 to mean a certain value. The other one may use the 0 to mean a certain value. I mean, they may disagree about whether it's negative or positive logic. Right? These are all things that can be canonicalized with very, very low overhead, and you can present a reasonably uniform interface, uniform as opposed to abstracted. And then build your abstraction layer above that, outside of the kernel. Right. That's the sort of competing proposition. Turns out it doesn't quite work out. Or at least there's a spectrum of possible outcomes. I mean, some of them it doesn't work out. Right? On one extreme end is, you know, the Linux Unix world, which says, forget the hardware, our job is to present an API. Right? At the other extreme is something like the exokernel work at MIT, which says, forget the API, our job is to present as much of the hardware as we can with as little anything as we can, except where we're obligated to restrict the hardware for the sake of protection or consistency. So for example, if I let every process have access to the supervisor bit, any story about security is over. That's a place where we have to put a layer of abstraction or protection in the system. Or we have to say we're not building a secure system. That's also a legitimate answer. The middle position that says, well, there's merit to having an API, but we're not going to go for a high-level API like MMAP. We're maybe going to choose an API that maps pretty directly to the hardware of most systems, but then, of course, there's always going to be that case of the hardware that's different somewhere. That's the position that Kyoto's takes. And I should add that at the time that that architecture was created, there were no counterexamples of hardware that worked in a different way. So it looked very much like it was directly capturing the hardware. Later evolution in hardware architecture would then sort of violate that statement retroactively. So let me show you what the Kyotos data structures look like. Kyotos has an object that's implemented by the kernel called a process. So what's in a process? It's a register set. It's an address space capability as opposed to a register. We're going to derive the hardware register value from that capability, and we'll find out how in due course. Okay. It's got a second register set that holds capabilities. So when we need to be explicit, we're going to refer to the first one as the data register set. And then it has a couple of further additions. The one that's going to be of greatest interest to us is the fault handler entry capability. And let me give you a clue as to what that is, and then we're going to ignore it for a while. I have a program that performs a divide by zero. What should the kernel do about it? The point about divide by zero is it's an illegal operation. There's no well-defined result, and the hardware actually will generate an exception when you do this. Most hardware will generate an exception when you do this. So what should the kernel do? It's pretty clear that my program has just done something irretrievably stupid. It's not very high likelihood that we can recover the program at this point. So what should my kernel do?
Terminate the process.
Why?
With the status message flag.
No, why, not how. Why?
Because you cannot recover it.
Okay, so it's clear that it can make no useful further progress, so there's no point trying to run more instructions. Why should I terminate the process? What does it mean, terminate? Can you expand on that word? You're talking mechanism. I'm asking meaning. What does terminate mean?
Well, you just stop the process continuing.
Okay, so we cease to attempt to execute instructions. What else does it mean when we talk about terminating a process usually?
We just release all the stack allocations.
So we release its resources. Why?
So that maybe anyway it's no use.
Well, if the process is not going to execute more instructions, it's not going to ask for more resources, and we won't allocate resources that it doesn't ask for. Why do we want to release the resources that it has?
Maybe we can allocate more resources in place of the process.
Okay, so the argument is that by releasing resources, we're going to free them up for other uses. Right? And that is indeed the argument in the classic OS literature. What resources are we trying to free up?
Stack space, memory, and file allocations. File opens.
No. I'm not trying to free up the file opens. I'm trying to free up the kernel storage, the main memory kernel storage, that those data structures occupy. I don't know if the next process is going to need to open files or run network packets or run in an infinite loop. What I do know is to get that next process moving, I'm going to need to allocate data structures. So the reason is I'm trying to free up kernel memory so that I can then reuse that memory for something else. Good. Do I have to actually destroy the resources of the existing process in order to do that? I hear a couple of people muttering no, but they don't sound very sure because they're muttering very quietly. So who wants to try to say no and tell me why?
No, you can just write all that stuff to disk or whatever. I mean, if you're using Kyotos, you can just atomically save the process data to disk and then free the memory, right?
So I don't know about the atomically part, but you could certainly page it out to disk and then reclaim the memory for other uses. Notice that when you do that, in a certain sense, you haven't solved anything, right? You've pushed the process from expensive memory to cheap memory. It's still chewing up resource, right? But it's chewing up much cheaper resource Good. So suppose I were to reclaim the resource. Right? So the kernel's going to go around. We're not doing a thought experiment. The kernel's going to go around, much as Unix actually does, and it's going to say, good, this process structure is now gone. What does it do with it? What happens to that process structure when it's no longer needed? It gets deallocated. Where does it go?
Is it allocated from a slab?
It depends on the kernel. More generically, it goes back to the free memory pool, right? Good. So the next process comes along and says, well, I need a process structure. Where does it get it from? Free memory pool, right? Okay, now, what is our evidence that this new process has the authority to allocate memory? Why do we believe that it should be permitted to allocate a process structure? I mean, that's a concrete, real resource. If we give it to this process, we can't give it to another process, right? So why should we let it do that? Okay, so you can introduce a process create permission. Good. But now we have a process that allocates 500,000 processes, and it wants 500,001. Should we just do it?
If you did it for 500,000, why not do it for one more?
There is an argument that says once you're naked in public, you might as well enjoy it. I mean, that's fair. We are still begging a prior question, though. Watch, next week somebody's going to come in with a co-ed naked programming sweatshirt or something like that. I don't know. Maybe those have died. Has that gone away? Okay. Look, it doesn't matter whether it's process 500,001 or whether it's process 10. Right? We're still allocating resource, and that resource is in finite supply. This is the difference between kernels and the rest of computer science. Right? In kernels and systems programming, we're actually accountable for our actions. Right? The world, in fact, does not consist of an infinite pool of memory cells. When you notice a machine that actually comes equipped with an infinite pool of memory cells, please call me. When you run out, it's over. Right? The next thing you do is pull the plug out of the wall and put it back in. Right? So this question of should I allow something to allocate memory is not a trivial question. It looks very simple when you're asking about one or two. Right? It's another matter when you're asking about 90% of the available physical memory. So I'm going to go back to my question. Why should we believe that this new thing should be able to allocate a process? And what I'm pointing out basically is the process create authority is much too coarse for what we're trying to get at. It's not a yes or no question. So why should we believe it? What alternative could there be? Okay, so what's the middle? So good. So we got two extremes. One says, always say yes. The other says, always say no. Is there a middle position we could adopt? I know you know the answer.
How processes have a quota of processes that they
can
start?
A quota of processes they could start. So in Unix terms, we could have a fork quota, right?
But that one prevents your...
You guys know about the Unix Erno contest? This was held before most of you were born. There was a contest I'm just full of these completely worthless diversions. You'll find this out. There was a contest to propose new error messages to be added to erno.h. Uh-oh. It wasn't that funny. And you had to submit both what the identifier would be and what it would mean. So one of the submissions was Emily Post. Emily Post may be another one of these icons that's now gone. Do you know who Emily Post is? Emily Post wrote a column in the newspaper about etiquette. Right? There's things like, you know, how you should dress when you go to a party in high society and you know, which one's the salad fork and which one's the regular fork and which one's the dessert fork and all this crazy stuff that engineers tend not to care a lot about. Okay. So the proposed identifier for the new error message was EMily post. Right? The recommended diagnostic was wrong fork. the scene entry, there was a contest held, the scene you could come up with the best. The scene entry was Eno tobacco, read on an empty pipe. And this contest was started at a Usenix conference with, you know, 1,800 attendees. And there were like, you know, 70 of these things generated of roughly, you know, equal quality to those. And I will not actually tell you all of them. I'm sure that comes as a great relief.
Google's your friend.
What?
Google's your friend.
Google's your friend, yes. Usenix AirNode contest. And some of them were pretty funny. Okay. Where was I when I started that diversion? Fork! Right. So you could have a quota that could say, your process can do so many forks. Or more precisely, it can have so many outstanding sub-processes. Right? Because you'd like to be able to do another one when one of them has the good grace to die. Yeah?
Before you introduce the sub-process in the notation, limiting forks does really help because, I mean, I can fork 10 times and then each of those processes can go off and fork.
I was about to go there.
That doesn't really buy you anything.
Well, it depends on how that quota gets inherited.
Yeah, it depends on how you do it.
So, quota isn't quite the right, so just having a counter isn't quite the right model because, as you say, right, so then each of my trial processes will allocate 10 processes, okay? And if we continue in this direction, you end up with the Usenet free space scheme, okay? Here's how it works. You run out of storage on your local computer, you need more space, okay? So what you do is, you know, you free up a little bit of space and you send out a piece of email. You send 10 free blocks to your best friend, and you ask them to send 10 free blocks to 10 of their best friends. And after a while, all these free blocks come back to you in the mail, and then you have more space, right? Okay. How many people think you have more space? When this I'm really relieved to see that. Okay, good. Good. Like I said, full of useless diversions. Right, so this idea that I have a limit of 10 subprocesses won't work, and it won't work for two reasons. One is the inheritance issue, and the other is, so, 10's an arbitrary number. Why isn't it 11? Why isn't it 2? Why isn't it 400? So what we actually want is a notion that allocating a data structure of this sort, or in this case an object, is an accountable operation. And we want that to be first class. What we really want to have is a storage pool of processes. And I'm going to wave my hands for a minute about where that storage comes from. And you have so many processes in your storage pool, you can allocate that many. You can use them for whatever you want. You cannot use them if such is your pleasure. Perhaps you feel like having 10 allocated processes running around in case you should need them. But that's it. And it's not up to me how you use them. What you do in the privacy of your own process structure is not my business. Fortunately, some of my earlier quotes along these lines were before I started recording my classes. Also, before I learned about, what's the Hopkins faculty quote of the day thing, the Daily Jolt? So I let out with a few gems before I knew about the Daily Jolt. And help them sell their newspapers on 1 or 2 days, or whatever they are. Anyway, so we want a first-class notion of resource. Because we need to be accountable, because when you run out of memory, that's all there was. Now, that's not going to stop us from running out of memory. But it will give us a place to stand to decide what to do about it. And to plan in ahead, to plan ahead for those things that must not run out of memory. Give me an example of something that must not run out of memory. One certainly hopes the kernel does not run out of memory. A well-designed kernel runs in constant memory. Please note that rules Windows and Unix out of the class of well-designed kernels. Kyotos actually does run in constant memory. That's not quite precise. It comes up and it looks at how much physical memory you have. It establishes an initial partition and then lives within its means. And the overwhelming majority of that memory is actually cache of your state. And we'll come back to that. An example of a process that better not run out of memory. How many of you have been on a modern manufacturing floor? There are these things out there called robots. I regret to report they are not as sexy as the robots in the Asimov movies. I regret to report Asimov would not have enjoyed the Asimov movies. They do bear some resemblance to the original works. They share a title.
Share a couple of names.
Yes, character names. Titles and character names. Yes, good. Good. They're not unique in this deficiency. On real manufacturing floors, you have things like laser cutters. You have things like robots that weld things. You have things like robots that insert bolts into things. And if you're between the bolt and the place it's going, it's really just too bad. Because the robot don't care. You have robots that move nuclear fuel rods. This is a job you don't want. Well, at least not after they've been used. These robots have safety measures that are designed to stop things like bolts from going through, humans who aren't smart enough to stay out of the way. Since most humans are not, in fact, smart enough to stay out of the way, and the robots move pretty fast, these safety provisions are actually worth having. This would be a bad sensor application to have fail. The consequences have a way of being permanent. This is a class of programs where, as a programmer, you design this kind of program to be able to run in resource that is fixed, that is known at the time of program deployment, and then you damn well provision the system to make sure you've got the resource. If you don't, you don't start the system. Because after the bolt goes through your chest, the I didn't have enough memory story is not going to hold a lot of water in court. I'm sorry I could not extract the welder from your posterior because my attempt to allocate a new stack page failed. Which side of that lawsuit do you want to be on?
Neither.
Right, yes. That's exactly right.
Ow. Whoa.
I will leave off on posteriority jokes. He said, telling a posteriority joke. Good. So there are things where we really need to allocate resources in advance. And what we generally have is a short list of things like that that really must not fail, and then an awful lot of the rest of the system where as long as it doesn't fail most of the time, that's okay. Your word processor falls into the second category. What if you run out of swap space, Word or OpenOffice or whatever your word processor of the day is will crash if it's the lucky winner when you run out of swap space. My personal favorite, there's a program in Linux called bdflush that used to exist, that used to be responsible for flushing your disk cache out to the disk. And of course, your programs get paged out. And occasionally, Linux would decide that bdflush had not run in quite a while, and there were other things going, and it would page it out, and then it wouldn't page anymore. Okay. So back to my comment that it's none of my business what you do with your processes. It's also none of the kernel's business. I want to do forensics on that process. You want to debug it, you may have a recovery strategy, you may have a program that's just not allowed to fail, and you may have a second agent that knows how to dig it out of the hole it's dug its way into. Now, that's not to say you shouldn't kill the process. That's a fine policy for dealing with a process that has gone astray in the wrong ways. It's not the only policy. Right? And it's not the kernel's job to impose that policy on you. Does the kernel need to free the resource? I could make a strong case. The argument is no. It's your memory to do with as you want. If you want to leave a dead process hanging around it, that's just fine. In this case, we don't actually have to take quite that draconian a position. The alternative is we can page the process out, let it remain accessible, but let it not tie up expensive resources. Okay. I will come back to this thread, but I want to finish the data structure discussion. All right. So unfortunately, I put all my text on the right side of my process picture here. So I'm going to draw the process again over here. It says process, by the way. One thing I actually would appreciate feedback on, I know for people in the back of the room with glare, it is impossible no matter how big I write, but if you can't see what I'm writing, ask me. Okay, and what's in a process? Basically, it's the hardware state plus some stuff that we're going to add that's sort of in a different world the hardware would have had, like capability registers. And I'm going to come back to the capability issue, surprise. What's a reasonable sort of atomic unit of data allocation for your address space? Page. If we go below that, the hardware can't help us. That's called Java. And there's an argument that that's not a bad outcome, that actually the cost of language protection carefully implemented and the cost of hardware protection carefully implemented, both with appropriately mature implementations, is about equal. And that's actually, I think, exactly right. At least that's what the data says right now. Equal is a very funny word, right? This is a metric of total overhead. And they both run about 2 or 3% when all is done. You do want to ask about the variance, right? Because if that 2 or 3% all comes all at once, it's very expensive. If it's spread out, it's manageable. And by and large, the language protection overhead, part of it, a critical part of it is the storage allocator, and the storage allocator overhead comes all or nothing. Those of you who've dug into garbage collection a little bit, there's discussion in the literature of real-time garbage collectors. There are no such things. Right? There are garbage collectors that are real-time except in a couple of corner cases. Right? Real-time means that the rate of collection keeps up with the rate of allocation. Dynamite. Yes, I need to not run out of memory. That's a good thing. But there's a very important number you've got to look at, which in that literature is called the mutator rate. The mutator rate is a sort of pernicious label which describes how fast that your program runs. What percentage of the processor does it get to use? You'd really like this number to approach 100%. The best real-time collector stuff I've seen, the mutator rate is 50%. So if you're willing to give up half your processor, you can get real-time collection.
Wait, it's the virus checker.
Not going. Okay, so for the moment, although this may change with further progress in the state of the art, you don't want to go below a page because that's a unit the hardware will help you with. You may want to go above a page, but the proposal is that we should do that by coming up with some means to aggregate pages. And in the theory that we'd like to get out of the way of the hardware and expose it as much as possible, the proposal is that the unit at the bottom should be the data page. Okay, semantics question. The kernel care what's in your data page? The kernel depend on what's in your data page? Why not?
It might not be.
It might not be there. Let's take that one away. I agree that's an issue, but
I think it depends on how your kernel stores itself. For example, on the Linux kernel, there are kernel data structures that are essentially in your processes, address space using your web pages, and you'll have the right to those pages even though they're
good.
So
good. I agree. Let's take kernel data structures out of the discussion. I meant your page.
Okay.
Should the kernel depend on the content of your page? What would it mean if the kernel depended on the content of your page?
You could change the,
behavior of the kernel. Does this strike you as a feature? If you're one of those people who gets paid $3 per machine month to provide zombie machines to people who want to do denial of service attacks, yes, this strikes you as a feature. If you're one of those people, don't tell me. Could it make sense? I would say not in a protected multiprocessing system, but I have to put a caveat on this. There are places where any kernel is going to depend on the content of your data, specifically where you are invoking the kernel interface and your data expresses what it is that you are asking the kernel to do. There is a sense in which the kernel's behavior is guided by application data. The important point there is, if we were going to do something like a verification about behavior, This is the case where in the verification, we would not actually look at the user's data, right? In the place where we would read the byte of the user's data, we would introduce an operation called a choose. And choose means, I'm going to get back a byte of data. I don't know what the value is. It can be any value that's in the legal range of expressible values in a byte, and the kernel's behavior has to be well-defined and sensible, regardless of which value I actually got back. So it's sort of, you end up, this is the way people who do verification talk about, let me make sure things are defined in all cases. This takes me back to the comment I think I made last week about Unix man pages, that they tell you the errors you could get, but they don't tell you how. Not defined in all cases. Okay. What about in the middle? How are we going to organize these pages into an address space? All of you actually read things from last week. All right, the proposal is we're going to build something like a page table structure. And let me be clear, page table structures are not the only way to do address translation, and this proposal may not be a good idea. Page table structures have strengths and weaknesses. Really good at dealing with cases where you have a lot of dense things at the leads, a lot of adjacent pages that are defined, but those collections of density are then relatively sparse in real programs. And so you may see density in the leaf page tables, these leaf page tables. You don't tend to get density in the page directories. So you get good utilization here, lousy utilization here, and this story gets worse as the address space gets bigger. And there's a credible story that what you want is a hybrid, right, that's real good for dealing with sparsity at the top and then good for dealing with density at the bottom. The problem with this is hardware really likes to do things just one way. There's certain kinds of algorithms that are just difficult to express in hardware with any sort of efficiency. Okay, so what we have in Kyotos is a sort of several generations removed page table structure. It's called a GPT, which stands for guarded page table. And much like the hardware page table has a fixed number of slots, GPT has a fixed number of slots. We chose 16. There's nothing magic about that number. There are good arguments that it should be a little larger than that. And so essentially, what you build is a tree of GPTs, or, let me stick with tree for a minute. Those leads are these pages that we're trying to establish mapping for. And just as in the hardware page table, right, we took an index through the address, we had page offset, and we have these two indexes that told us which entries to look at. The same thing with GPTs. Now, the tree is going to have more levels, so we're going to have more indexes, and they're going to be smaller. But by this point, you guys understand how to deal with trees that are more than two levels deep. Now, let me go back to that 64-bit statement. Why is it that the sparsity is a problem in a 64-bit address space? A hierarchical page table. Tell me. Suppose my addressing scheme required a four-level page table scheme, which is what the AMD64 does. And by the way, that only translates in 48 bits. Am I going to get reasonable utilization at the bottom level? You're saying no. Why not? It's true that there's going to be stuff all over the place, but that's actually not relevant to the question I asked. At the leaves, the behavior is determined by what's the structure of a binary image. So if I had 40 kilobytes of code in a 32-bit machine that was adjacent, I almost certainly have 40 kilobytes of code that's adjacent when the same program is compiled for a 64-bit machine. That's going to determine what my utilization looks like at the bottom. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about dense clusters at the bottom. What's going to happen in the level above that?
From there all the way up.
Sparse. On average, how many entries are going to be occupied in the page table above that? One. Strictly speaking, unless we know a little more about the program, we can't answer this question. If it's an X Windows program, the answer is lots of them, because all X Windows programs are infinitely large. But in order to get, think about it this way, if this bottom level page table can dominate 4 megabytes of linear virtual address, adjacent virtual address, contiguous virtual address, then the only way I'm going to get 2 entries in the table above it is if I needed more than 4 megabytes of contiguous stuff. Emacs is a really good way to demonstrate that. Emacs will occupy all the memory you will give it, and then it will garbage collect. And it will still, by the way, occupy all of the memory that you gave it. It won't use it. Nuclear bomb simulations, hey, all the memory you can eat. There are other examples. A DNA matching, right? All the memory you can eat. Good. Now we're done with all five of the programs that have, you know, large contiguous spaces for large values of five. Most of the rest of the world is, you know, it's amazing. BinLS doesn't seem like a program that you should think a lot about. It gets run a lot of times, and it's very short-lived. In fact, program behavior is very bimodal. Young programs die young, and old programs live forever. There's very little in the middle ground. Database systems use big contiguous memory regions. Good. How many of those are you going to run on a given machine? One? In my case, probably zero. As you work your way up the tree, you get less and less utilization. So if I have a four-layer tree, here's what I'm probably going to see. I'm going to see page tables that have some number of entries used. I'm going to see that as bottom-level page tables. Right? Let me call them level zero page tables, because I don't want to argue about whose terminology we're going to use. At level one, I'm going to see, on average, one entry used. At level two, I'm going to see, on average, one entry used, because something had to name level one. And then at the top, I'm going to see a couple of entry used, because you had text and data, code and data at the bottom, and you would stack at the top. And somewhere in the middle, you had some shared libraries, so that was at least three subtrees that had to make their way to the top. Great, you've got three times the utilization there that you got at the next level down. Average utilization in this story, less than 0.1%. Less than one entry in 1,000 on average. That's probably one. The dense guys at the bottom are very dense, so it'll skew that number. But if you were to say, how many of my page tables have utilization above 0.1%? Totally small number. Okay. So this data structure is not very good at dealing with sparsity. And most of the reason is the need for these intervening layers that exist only to connect the dots. So observe that if there's only one valid entry in a layer, it follows that there's only one legal path through that layer. And if you could simply have specified that path at the next level up, you wouldn't have needed the extra layer. And Motorola actually built a processor in which you can do this. Right? The 88,000 multi-memory management unit has a three-layer scheme. It turns out, by the way, their implementation in this case isn't very useful, but it'll get you the idea. And at the top layer, you can say, by the way, here I have an entry. You think it ought to name something in the middle layer? It doesn't. It names something in the bottom layer. And here's what the missing bits have to be. That's exactly what a guarded page table does. So in addition to the pointer that points to the next GPT down, a guarded page table has something that we call a guard. And Scott, I apologize, I'm rotating terms here. Guard consists of a pair. Logically, a guard is just a number. There's a representation issue that we don't have enough bits to represent all the numbers we'd like to be able to represent, because we have to squeeze this guard into a capability. So we only get about 32 bits. We're trying to express a 64-bit address. I will not ask you again how many times 64 fits into 32. So a guard has two components, which we refer to as a match and an L2G. L2G log base 2 of the guard. Why log base 2 of the guard? Because that field used to be called the guard. Sorry. And here's the idea. If I want to ask what's the guard value, right? It's the L2G times the match. So here's how this works. Here's an address that I'm in the middle of translating. So I've translated some bits at the top. Let's take those out. I'll put X's in. Those bits are now translated, and from this point forward, we're going to say they have to be zero. Okay? And let me give you an intuition for why that makes sense. Remember over here, we pulled out these two index fields. Now imagine for a minute the address extended infinitely far to the left with zeros off the top. And the reason we got away with fixing the length of the address was we knew that there were never going to be any valid mappings above 2 to the 32 or 2 to the 64. Why? Because the hardware doesn't do that. One way to think about the arithmetic is I'm extracting these bit fields and using them as indexes. But another way to think about the arithmetic is, look, this field, this bit field up at the top that I used to go into the top level page table, it was really an infinitely long 2's complement number. And I happen to know that all the only non-zero bits are down in the bottom. And I'm going to use it as an index in this table. Well, now I've consumed that index. Having consumed the index, if I now zero those bits, at least in my head, I can now adopt the same logic at the next level down. And I'm now about to tell you why I might want to do that. This is just a mental trick. We haven't actually changed the processing at all. So I have some bits at the top that I have already translated. I have some bits at the bottom that are the page offset that I'm not going to translate, or I'm going to translate them only in the sense that I'm going to run them through the identity translation. Very complex to implement, that identity translation. And there are also some bits down at the bottom that when I'm done making my way through whatever part of the tree I'm looking at, there may still be some bits left to translate, right? Because I may not do it all in one step. VA prime, meaning the virtual address that will remain when this step has been performed. About that stuff in the middle. If I did not have a guard mechanism, I would say, well, okay, this stuff in the middle must be the index. What we do with the guard mechanism is we put in a new step. New step says, there's some bit position in this picture, L2G. L2G has to be bigger than page size, or excuse me, bigger than log 2 of page size. What we're going to do is we're going to chop off the address. At that point, we're going to take the upper portion of the address using that point as a dividing line. And we're going to ask whether its value equals the match element. And the reason I kept talking about an infinite number of zeros off to the left is, unfortunately, the match field has a fixed width, and it may not match the width of the thing we're trying to match. So when these two widths don't quite align, we need to understand how we're going to interpret the number. And the answer is we're going to interpret it as a value. So here's the idea. When I go to translate through a guarded page table, step one is I see if there's a guard. If there's a guard, I compare the match value to the upper bits. If they don't match, I'm done. The translation is not valid. If they do match, I now take these bits out. I have translated them, and then I use the next set of bits as the index. So what's happening is that the guard and the match are replacing that entire level of page table, or in this case, GPT, that only had one entry. But if it only had one entry, there was only one index value that was interesting, and that index value is going to get encoded in the match. We'll go through this path because the idea makes sense. If it's a guard and it doesn't match, this is an invalid translation, and we'll do whatever we do with an invalid translation, which is generally raise a fault. One way to think about the match is, well, this is just an index field, but instead of using it to index into a table, we're going to do a comparison. And the L2G is simply telling us where the index field is.
What happens to the bits?
They remain. They're part of the residual virtual address that we're now going to translate.
Oh, you see.
Right. And if I don't want an L2G, if I don't want a match, what I do is I basically set the L2G value so that it works out to be exactly here to the bits I've already translated, and then I set the match value to 0. I don't have to use the match. It's just there if I want to skip a level or even multiple levels. This is just a representation trick. When I say it's just a representation trick, I mean if we take a tree that is expressed with these guard and match values, we have an infinite source of additional GPTs off on the side that we can use. There's a deterministic algorithm for inserting those spare GPTs into the tree and taking out all of the actual use of the match mechanism. And every one of those inserted GPTs will have exactly one valid slot. Not only is there a deterministic algorithm for doing it, there is a deterministic algorithm that preserves maximal sharing of subtrees. And the existence of this algorithm is Mr. Dowry's fault. It's actually a nice thing to know about, because it lets us know that if we're going to try to reason about how translation works in this system, that there's a meaning-preserving transformation to a simpler system. And in fact, it turns out he came up with three primitives, and these three primitives will also let us convert to systems in which the GPTs have different widths. Why would we want to do that? Well, so there's a particular degenerate GPT that might be of interest to us, which is the GPT whose width exactly matches that of the hardware page table and which doesn't use any guard bits because the hardware didn't. And if we can show an algorithm that uses only three primitive operations that can transform an arbitrary GPT into a second arbitrary GPT just by turning the crank on these three operations in a way that preserves all of the mappings, we can then ask whether our translation algorithm is formally correct. Hopefully we can show that it is. Pretty sure it's not yet. Okay. It's not so much that I wanted to get into a long a discussion of GPTs, so much as that I wanted you to see the primary data structure. Let me make sure this is still recording. Ah, it's still recording. Amazing. And then there's another data structure which you've seen, and it's the one that's used in inter-process communication, which is, if I have a process that wants to send a message to this one, I can introduce this thing called an endpoint. Now, Hyannis uses these data structures regardless of what hardware platform you're on. GPT, process, we'll change the register set to match your hardware, but there is a process data structure in all implementations, and it holds basically the same stuff. The GPT is present without regard to what hardware architecture you're on. The page size changes to match your hardware, but the idea that a page is present doesn't. And much of the job of the kernel is to translate from this representation of what your address space looks like to that representation, or whichever one your hardware uses. So when I said last week that the kernel, most of its memory acts as a cache of your data structures, those are the data structures. And in contrast to most operating systems where when you say mmap, kernel fabricates some data structures internally. You don't have any say in what those data structures are. In fact, it's free to implement them differently from one implementation to the next. Your only influence on those data structures is indirect. You can unmap things, new things. But you didn't allocate those data structures. The kernel did on your behalf. There's two problems with that. First is that the relationship between the operations that you did and the data structures that the kernel allocated is both, be careful. I was going to say it's not deterministic. Actually, it is deterministic. There's a very concrete algorithm with concrete steps that get followed to determine what data structures the kernel is going to allocate. There's no obvious relationship between the results of those steps and the requests that you made. If you map three pages that are adjacent, you're going to get one set of data structures. If you map three pages in random locations in your address space, you're going to get a different set of data structures. Storage occupied by those data structures is going to change pretty dramatically. Because in one case, they're all going to fit in one structure, and in the second case, you're going to need three. And then you're going to need a parent. Because you're going to need to know where the three went. Okay, let me go back to an earlier question. I'm going to do a one-word substitution. Why do we believe that your process, is your application, is authorized to allocate those data structures? And here, quota systems don't work very well. Systems work well when you as a developer can clearly understand what the consequences of your operations are. You want to know, in a quota system, if I map a page, it's going to cost me a certain amount. And I know what that amount is, and there's not, or if I don't know exactly what that amount is, I know that it's a certain amount within a bounded variance. Here, the variance far exceeds the amount in the Unix design. So if we were to put quotas on the kernel mapping structures and associate those quotas with processes, we'd be in real trouble, because as a programmer, there's no good way for you to understand what the underlying behavior is, and there's therefore no good way to make a good determination about what the quota should be. you don't believe me, go try developing on VMS for a few years. Because VMS has this problem in spades. Not only that, but it's got quotas at multiple levels of abstraction, often in places where one layer depends on the other layer, and you can't always tell which one of the quotas did you in. Abstraction is about hiding things. Robustness is about understanding what the hell's going on. These two statements are not compatible. It's not to say that I don't want to enforce encapsulation. I do. And encapsulation is about saying there should be a well-defined interface you have to go through, and its behavior should be well-specified, and there should be no way for you to bypass it. That's not what people actually mean when they talk about abstraction. That's usually what they say abstraction means. The Java implementation, right, the Java standard library, is a very well-abstracted library. When you make a call into that library, you have absolutely no clue what happens.
Neither does Sun Microsystems.
Neither does Sun Microsystems. That's actually sadly correct. And I'll give you a concrete example. How many of you have run into the I can deadlock a thread, any thread problem in Java? All you have to do is build a GUI. Okay? The hidden assumption in the object locking model in Java was that all threads proceed from main. Of course, the GUI threads do not proceed from main. There are actually quite a number of paths you can get into in Java where an action that starts from the GUI, right, starts into something, runs some callback that some other thread is locked down for some reason. At this point, we get to what I think of as the ILO problem. When two trains are scheduled to come into a crossing within 5 minutes of each other, both must stop and neither can continue until the other has passed out of sight. This law is actually on the books. Presents interesting problems for train schedulers. Not the problems that you want to debug behind an opaque interface in something as completely transparent in its behavior as a threading system. There's a point to the rant. The point to the rant is that we want a certain kind of transparency. We want to understand what's going on, and the caveat is that if we accept that kind of transparency, then we also have to undertake a certain kind of discipline as programmers. This is something that computer scientists in particular are historically very bad at. Discipline and computer scientists usually doesn't go together. The discipline is that we have to promise ourselves that we're not going to exploit artifacts of implementation. Right? There's a difference between what's the contract and what's the current implementation. So on the one hand, the discipline is we actually have to specify the contract in a usable way, and on the other, the discipline is we have to promise not to exceed the contract in what we rely on as a matter of behavior. This is not always possible. TrueSort and BubbleSort have very different performance characteristics. You're inserting one item into a sorted list, right? QSort is not your friend. It will happily reshuffle every single entry in the vector. Each time somebody goes and proves to you that QSort is the preferred sort, ask them which case they're looking at. This whole thing about, you know, the best memory allocator, right? Operating system authors are not the only people who engage in that class of fallacy. Okay, so why GPTs? Why not something like MMAP? Answer. Look, the unpredictability of the data structures is actually an inherent problem. It has to do with that locality and sparsity. It really is the case that three pages allocated in random places in your address space, just you have to record more information to manage them than if you pack them together. This is information theory, right? You can't compress stuff that's random. That data structure optimization is a form of compression. What you can do is make the allocations explicit. So the proposal here is we don't actually want an MMAP. Or if we do, we want to put it at a layer where that's above this layer. And I'll come back to why. What we want is our primitive layer is something where every data structure we allocate deliberately and on purpose. And then if you want to build a layer that manages the complexity of that tree management for you and deals with the allocation issues, right, and has some slop and a fair bit of variance, and in your application that's perfectly tolerable because you know what's going on, or you want to focus on a different part of the application and you're willing to tolerate that slop and that variance, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. Well, it depends on your application. But the kernel shouldn't hand you an interface that already forces you into that dark corner. Because then there's a short list of applications, like the one that stops the robot from putting the bolt through your chest, that you can't run. You can't even express. So the argument here is the job of a microkernel is maybe about canonicalization, and some people would argue not, but it's not about abstraction. It's not about hiding things. If anything, it's about forcing you to accountability. It's going to turn out there is one place where that does not appear to be possible, or at least nobody knows how to do it. Having made some grand and pop... Go ahead, yeah, sorry.
So a question about GPT from a security perspective. So GPT is referring to GPT, and presumably the last ones can refer to pages.
Yep.
But they can't actually just refer to pages, right? They can't give an address or zip address and go from there, locally and securely. So how do you actually point at a page?
Good. I was actually about to step forward to the next step, and I'm really glad you interrupted me because it reminded me there was something else I had to do here, which turns out to answer exactly that question. So if a page table points to pages, right? How did it do it? Well, it had this page table entry structure, and the page table entry structure, was a page address, in this case a physical page address, and a set of permissions. And if the GPT is going to serve as our analog to a page table structure, then it's going to need something that corresponds to a page table entry. One of the very first things I said last week, I introduced a capability. What was in a capability? In fact, I did a couple of versions of capability. And I said we were mostly going to ignore the details, and you believe me. Anybody remember what's in a capability? That was one version. So one version was an object ID and a set of permissions, right? And then I went off on this thing about signatures and said permissions is really a shorthand for a signature. And that when we talk about object ID, we don't mean object in the language sense, and we don't even mean object in the sense of a process. What we really mean is object in the sense of a particular piece of representation state, that is a data structure. A particular data structure. That's true in the same sense that this page address names a particular data structure. It's called a physical page frame. The page table entry is in fact a capability. Of course, it's not always true. There are other kinds of capabilities. By the time I was done, I said, well, we might actually shove a type field into the capability so that we could distinguish between a capability that's supposed to point to a page versus a capability that's supposed to point to a guarded page table versus a capability that's supposed to point to a process. You could equally well have encoded that within the ID. Convenient to separate it. Now, the page table entry in its guise as a capability is a protected capability. It's protected because you don't get to play with it. The kernel does that. And in a certain sort of way, the memory hierarchy portion of a conventional processor is a hardware capability system. We don't normally think of it that way because you don't get to play with the capabilities. But in the case of a GPT, each slot in the GPT is going to consist of a capability. It's going to contain a capability. And it's always going to contain a capability in the same sense that every entry in a page table contains a page table entry. It may be an invalid one, but it's got to be there. You can't declare an integer variable in C without it containing some value. It's a location. It's got to have some bits in it. So to answer your question, the way we're going to fabricate this tree is we're going to obtain a page from a storage allocator. What does that mean? We're going to get handed back a capability. What does that mean? Well, a capability is going to happen, a copy is going to happen that's going to copy it into our kernel data structures, and we're going to get told the name of the place where the capability got stored. You can't manipulate register 5 in the hardware, correct? You can name register 5 and instruct the hardware to manipulate register 5. This is a subtle distinction, and most of the time, it's not a useful distinction, and so we ignore it. And idiomatically, we'll say, well, you allocate a page and you get back a capability. But you, the application, get back a capability only in this, on the other side of the curtain, don't pay attention to the wizard kind of sense. Right? You don't get it back in the sense that you can manipulate its bits. You get it back in the sense that you specify where it should be placed, and having placed it there, you can then invoke it and ask it to do whatever it is it authorizes. And that's true in the same sense that you don't get to manipulate 5. Only get to invoke 5 in an operator and cause some new value to get produced. So capabilities are values, which we want to be programming language semantics. They're values in the same sense that 5 is a value. So the way in which we're going to assemble these trees is we're going to go to a storage allocator, we're going to say, I need a page. You know, back to the storage allocator, so it'd be really nice if I could get a GPT. We're then going to take that page capability and store it in a certain slot in that GPT. Which slot? Depends on where we want to map the page. We're going to say, you know, that GPT you gave me back, I forgot to ask you this, but I need it to have a certain guard value. Can you give me back a different capability to the same GPT that has encoded in it this guard value? It's actually an operation you can do on the GPT itself. Now you've got an address space built, and now you can go to this process that you've allocated and say, okay, good, here's the capability that names the address space of this process. So the capability that lives in the address space capability slot of the process is an exact analog to the pointer that lives in the address space register. In fact, in the hardware sense, it's very unfortunate that the address space register is a pointer. We would actually like it to be a page table entry so that we had consistent treatment of permissions at all levels. One way to think about this address space register is it is a degenerate single entry page table, which is so degenerate that they left out the permission bits. Degeneracy is only fun up to a point. Well, this sort of, good. And I promised that I would distinguish between pointers and capabilities by drawing these little keys next to them. With a little bit of luck, the correspondence between the hardware tree structure and the software tree structure could be starting to jump out. There is this open issue that this tree has a different arity than that tree, right? The nodes have a different number of children. Page tables have 1,000 or 512 children or whatever number, depending on the hardware. GPTs have 16. We're going to have to figure out how to reconcile that. We can. The other difference is we're taking advantage of the fact that the GPT structure is defined in software to let us do some tricks like skip some levels. In the hardware view, right, there are only 2 bit positions in the 32-bit Pentium hardware, right, that are defined as starting a page table. And they happen to be bit 22, which is this line, and bit 32, which is this line. And depending on how rigorous and purist you want to be, you could argue that bit 12 is sort of the bottom of the story. There's no other position where you can start a page table. With a GPT structure, by using the guard mechanism, you can start a page table at an arbitrary bit boundary. And we'll have to reconcile that too. And we can. We may not enjoy it, but we will. But look, the guard and the sort of variability of positioning, right, these are optimizations on representation. They're going to let us avoid allocating 5 billion GPTs to describe one address in a 64-bit address system for small values of 5 billion. They don't fundamentally change the data structure. They complicate the traversal algorithm, and we're going to have to account for why we haven't altered the power of the data structure, but we have. Right. So, almost at the break, and I will give you a teaser before we switch topics for the second half. Having done my pompous rant, something you may have learned that faculty are good at, not all faculty are good at, about the importance of accountability, now let me reverse myself. There's an old joke about what do you get if you put 10 rabbis in a room? The answer is 13 opinions. It's like that. Especially when you take a polarizing position like this and you say there's a design principle and we want to adhere to it very carefully, it's important to ask, well, what would happen if we didn't? And are there places where it's appropriate not to? And what are the consequences if we don't? You know, can we cheat? Where do we cheat? Where does it hurt if we cheat? Where can we not get caught? This sort of thing. So, observe that, suppose I have a GPT structure, I'm going to wave my hands by magic, and I'm going to come up with an algorithm that can walk this GPT structure, and you'll tell me for a certain virtual address, and the virtual address is really a path through a data structure, it'll tell me if that path is defined, and assuming it's defined, it'll tell me what page is at that address, and assuming there's a page at the address, it'll tell me what permissions apply to references on that page. And I'm prepared to believe that, you know, with a lot of consulting the manual and my navel and a bunch of other things, I can come up with an algorithm to walk the GPTs. Better still, I can tell my partner to write the algorithm, and then I'm saved all the effort. The algorithm exists. How useful is it to be able to write that algorithm if my goal is to run programs? It's clearly an algorithm I have to have. It's useful in that sense, because I'm not going to make much progress if I cannot translate addresses. But having run the software algorithm, what progress have I actually made? Nothing. So the hardware still doesn't know about this. At the end of the day, I have to take that result and I have to express it in a way that the hardware is willing to believe me about. This is the point where you look wistfully at the manual of available processor options and wish that the customer had not specified the Pentium. Because if you had a software-translated hardware architecture, you'd be done now. It's also the point where you wish that the ColdFire designers understood about cache coherency. Cache consistency, which they don't. There are a long list of embedded microprocessor vendors who don't understand about cache consistency, and I'll probably rant about that later when I'm in the middle of the ColdFire code. So you now have this answer, and you have this question. This is good. You know both the question and the answer. The question is the virtual address, and the answer is physical page address and permissions, and you need to stick them in that table. Unfortunately, we can do an algorithm that, given an answer, can insert it in the table. So far, so good. Of course, that assumes we have a table. Have a table, we're going to have to allocate a data structure. Why should we believe that your program is entitled to allocate this data structure? It's going to get very boring, right? You're going to know all the answers. What should we do about that? What did we do the last two times we did this? Does anybody remember what they had for dinner last night? Me neither. What did we do the last two times we hit this problem? We didn't do anything in the sense that we kind of waved our hands about it, but we said there's a class of solution that we want. So what was that? What's that? Permission bits. This has to, we're talking now about allocation and authority to allocate. So we wanted some kind of a first class mechanism for resource allocation, that if you were going to allocate something that occupied storage, we needed a quota mechanism. Right? And we wanted to say, well, you get so many and no more. And that we did that for processes, and then we did that for pages and GPTs, I think. I don't know if I did it explicitly for GPTs. So does that seem like something we would want to do for page tables? TAs are grinning evilly because they know that the answer here is not the one you expect. When I'm asking setup questions like this, just a hint for the future, the third time is almost never a charm. Okay? The answer here is no. Two reasons the answer is no. The first is the VMS bug. You don't want to do quota systems at two interacting levels of abstraction. Pick one and stick to it. And since the upper level is allocating real disk storage, we kind of have to have it there, so we're going to look for a way not to do it down here. But the second is the MMAP problem, and now I'm going to make the opposite argument. Right? There's no direct correspondence between what we allocated and it's deterministic, but it's not obvious what the correspondence is between what we built at the top and what we're going to get down at the bottom. In fact, what we're going to get down on the hardware level depends on the hardware. So, I mean, obviously, we want to write programs that are prepared to deal with all possible combinations of all possible hardware allocation patterns now and in the future. That's what future-proofing means. Okay. Notice, this hardware data structure is not the definitive statement of what the address map looks like. What do I mean by that? I mean, if I were to go through system memory and whack every last one of these data structures, I would not lose any information about your address space. How many people at this point are saying, huh? How did I generate these entries? What did I do? I turned the crank on another data structure. I took out the result, and I stored them over here. Why did I put them over here? Because the hardware wanted them that way, right? I was bowing at the Intel altar for some value of Intel. I'm using the hardware-defined specified data structures as a cache. Software-managed cache. It contains state that I can always rebuild by going to some other definitive data structure, namely the GPT's in the pass over there. How am I going to do that? What's really going to happen? Right? I'm going to get to running your process, and it's going to say, you know, I'd like to execute the first instruction. But I know where the first instruction is. I had this thing called a binary image, and it had this symbol called underscore start, which is an address, and that's the address of the first instruction. And the processor is now going to go try to get this instruction so that it can run it. And I'm going to wave my hands for a minute about scheduling and ask you to bear with me that, yes, we were actually authorized to run an instruction. At least let's engage consensually in the shared collective delusion that we were authorized to try to run this instruction for a moment. Good, so I turn to the hardware and I say, please execute the instruction at address 4010. And the hardware says, great, boss. 4010, who's got the byte at 4010? Can I get an answer for 4010? No! Why not? I don't have a valid address space. You don't have a valid address space. Nobody's bothered to load anything into my master address space register. What do you mean nobody's put anything in your master address space register? I mean, we can't run the kernel. We don't have anything in your master address space register. Okay, there's something in my master address space register, but it points to a page table that only defines kernel addresses. Cool. Okay. At this point, the hardware says, I cannot run the instruction at 4010. Do something about it. Okay? And it yanks the ripcord, which is University of Pennsylvania speak for a frozen exception. Thank you for playing. Come back next time. Okay, at this point, the operating system says, damn, that didn't get me very far. You know, what I need is an address translation. Let me go see if I can find one of those. Okay, I've got an address. I have an algorithm that knows how to use an address. Do I have a data structure? Maybe I do. Maybe I don't, in which case the answer is, yep, this is really an invalid address. In which case, we're going to go back to the discussion about whether we terminate the process, and the answer is no. We tell somebody else. At that point, we'll take the exception thing, we'll encapsulate it into a message, and we'll send it to a fault handler, namely the fault handler named by this fault handler capability, assuming one has been provided. Suppose I do have an address space defined. Well, now I run my translation algorithm, and I hopefully get a translation. If I don't, I'm going to go back to the fault handler. I get a translation. You know, now I've got an answer, and I have a question, but I don't have a data structure. I still need a page table. Well, I need a top-level page table, right? So what do? I got to allocate one. At this point, you run into trouble because I've said allocation is a bad idea. And you spank your hand every time you try to allocate something without an authorization. I have a 2.5-year-old. Spanking comes up a lot. I don't know. Actually, it doesn't come up a lot, which is probably how it ought to be. At this point, I allocate a page. The kernel allocates a page. From where? From a pool of data structures that have been reserved for this purpose in PowerUp. Or early in the kernel initialization. Now, why is this kind of okay? It's actually not, but it's maybe the best we can do. This allocation is not a hard commitment. There's some number of these top-level page table structures, we're going to use them up, and when we run out, we're going to steal one. We're going to steal one because, hell, we can rebuild it. Can you execute an instruction that's a load instruction and it pulls memory into a cache line, right? The cache line gets allocated. It can be deallocated. The consequence of deallocation is a loss of performance, not a change of semantics, ignoring issues of real-time programs. And that's the catch. If I have a real-time program, I'm going to have to tell a better story than this. That story, by the way, doesn't exist in the literature. Barring hard real time where I really can't get caught playing games that alter latency, I can always give this data structure back. And that means that a kernel can sensibly operate from a fixed pool of these data structures by recycling them. How many does it need? Depends a bit on what our workload is going to be, but it's actually a surprisingly stable set of ratios. Stable enough that you can pre-allocate them, and if you're off by a little, you won't really notice. A certain number of pages available in physical memory at PowerOn, we can probably tell you in advance how many top-level page tables you need. Good. So I'm going to go to put this address. I'm going to build the page table entry in the top-level page table. Of course, to do that, I need to know the address of the next page table down, and I don't have one of those. Allocate one of those. I'm going to work my way down the tree, and I'm going to insert the necessary entries, And now I'm going to restart the machine. I'm going to go back to userland and say, let's try again. And this time, depending on the instruction, I may actually run it all the way through. I will break it in a minute. I may actually run it all the way through. If it's a load instruction, in fact, it turns out if it's the first instruction, I probably won't run it all the way through, because the first instruction or the second instruction almost always turns out to be something that pushes something on the stack, and I haven't got a stack yet, and I'll have to do this whole exercise again to find the stack page. But the point is, I will establish a translation. And having established a translation that the hardware knows how to interpret, I can execute the instruction. Now, here's the point of this one. Not just that there are definitive data structures and cache data structures, and it's not just trying to sort of illustrate in a little more depth what I mean when I talk about the state of the Kyotos kernel memory being a cache. And I mean that pretty literally. We're going to see this pattern again and again. One last piece. So this means that I put some entries in a page directory and a page table, and those entries are a consequence, the output of an algorithm. I ran on those other data structures. If something changes the arrangement of those other data structures, and the information that I stored over in the hardware page tables becomes obsolete. If you unmap a page in the definitive structure, it better not stay mapped in the hardware structure. So it's not enough to translate over there and insert over here. I have to also maintain bookkeeping structures so that when a slot is stored in a GPT, overwritten in a GPT, I've built some data structure over there that relies on the value of that slot, I better make sure it goes away. I don't have to update it to a new value, I can just whack it, because when the new value is actually needed, I can rebuild it on the fly, but I do have to whack it, I have to invalidate the hardware entries. So there's a correspondence that has to be maintained between these two trees. What we want is to maintain the invariant that the permissions and the mappings that are expressed at any given instant in the hardware structures are a subset of the permissions and the mappings that are expressed in the definitive structures. That's the invariant that we have to maintain. And you're going to see the word invariant come up a lot in this kernel. And there are two other kernels in which the word invariant appears. Okay. So we're going to have to maintain dependency tracking structures. Now, about those dependency tracking structures, why do I have the authority to allocate those dependency tracking structures? At this point, people are saying, okay, you know, I went with the quota thing on the first two, and I got caught with my pants down on this third one. Now what? What happens if I run out of dependency structures? Can I get one back? What a dependency structure maintains is the relationship between slots over here and slots over there. Suppose I'm out and I need one. Can I just steal one? As long as the dependency doesn't have to guard anything, I can take the data structure back. So if I run out of dependency structures, what I do is say, aha, why is this here? This dependency structure exists so that when somebody whacks that slot, I can pull the ripcord. Why would I need to pull the ripcord? Because there's a valid entry over there. Oh, but if I knew there were no valid entries over there, I wouldn't need to pull the ripcord, and then I wouldn't need the dependency structure. If I didn't need the dependency structure, I could reuse it. And we'll go through the dependency structures, and I'll draw diagrams. But the point is, it's a cache again. The same kind of cache that the hardware structures are. It's a cache that's derived from other definitive information. If you go through this soft translation mechanism for every single step of the machine, it'd be hopeless. You could do it, you wouldn't enjoy the experience. Right? The idea is we're going to build all those high-performance data structures that the hardware knows how to interpret, and we're going to keep track of how to undo. At that point, I've sketched almost everything that the Kyotos kernel does. I mean, there's going to be lots of consequential damages and requirements we're going to have to deal with. The only other thing that the kernel has to implement is communication from one process to another, which we can't fully tell a story about just by talking about hardware data structures, and we'll get there. Okay, so let's take a 10-minute break, come back at 10 of 4, and we'll turn on a machine.